You're listening to Future Ready Through M&A. I'm your host, Scott Slater, Vice President of Practice Management and Consulting at Fidelity Investments. We're about to kick off the episode, but before we do, please be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or visit go.fidelity.com/mergers and acquisitions to listen to more episodes and to get the latest M&A insights. As a reminder, if you haven't listened to Season 1 yet, you can visit go.fidelity.com/mergers and acquisitions or find us on Apple Podcasts to catch up on the latest episodes. When I hear the word ecosystem, it brings me back to my middle school biology days with Dr. Moyle. He would take us on a class field trip to California Lake near our school and taught us all about all of the bugs and frogs and their habitat. Ecosystem, in the classic understanding of the term, describes the complex, dependent interrelationships between living organisms and their physical space. In business, it can be a popular but often overused buzzword, sort of like scale, which we discussed in the last episode. But both scale and ecosystem are really important priorities for wealth management firms which seek to thrive. So today, we want to get to the heart of the following. What do we mean by ecosystem in wealth management? And why does it matter? How does it influence what you're doing? And how can you take advantage of it to grow and compete? And finally, what does this growing ecosystem mean for the future of the independent wealth management space? As a starting point, a business ecosystem describes all of the components and key processes necessary to deliver on your value proposition. So it includes third-party providers and platform solutions and custodians like Fidelity. But it also includes, for example, your carefully cultivated centers of influence, the attorneys and the accountants you work with, relationships which are necessary to execute on your service offer to specific clients. Let's take a look at a February 2019 MIT Sloan Management Review article. It takes a look at this whole concept of business ecosystems and outlines four key components that I think we can see emerging in a variety of industries today. First, an ecosystem is multi-entity. It's made up of groups of companies or providers who aren't necessarily within a single organization, and likely aren't. Secondly, it involves networks of shifting and semi-permanent relationships. Third, it combines aspects of competition and collaboration. And fourth, it co-evolves and redefines capabilities and relations to one another over time. I think all of that sounds a little bit academic and even mysterious to many of us. So just how do you understand and then pull off this ecosystem idea? Well, a couple of years ago, I read Ron Adner's book on business ecosystem strategy, which is entitled The Wide Lens, What Successful Innovators See That Others Miss. He stresses that product and service innovation too often misses the mark because they overlook key partners that are critical to success. His opening example describes Michelin's foray into the flat run tire space in the early 2000s, an innovation that they created that consumers clearly desired. But ultimately, after several years, it failed because Michelin had not recognized the need to cultivate adoption by a critical part of their ecosystem, the service mechanics who would repair those flat-run tires. Despite creating a clearly superior product concept and great product execution, the supporting service infrastructure necessary for a successful consumer experience led to this innovation's downfall. So how is that possible? Companies like these focused too narrowly on the success of their own innovations and solutions. They didn't acknowledge their interdependence on their ecosystem of partners and providers. Now, the book does also include a number of very visible and well-recognized successes in this idea of ecosystem. Take Apple, for example. Their phones and iPods and iPads are ubiquitous today, but the success of Apple goes far beyond their ability to create tremendous products, which Steve Jobs was so attentive to. Through creations such as iTunes and their app developer platform and a number of other innovations, they've managed to engage people who don't even work directly for Apple to be able to support and enhance their ecosystem and thus make it all the more ubiquitous and something that is competitively very hard to challenge. And as our highly creative independent wealth management industry continues to grow and expand after over 30 years, we can see the expansion of our ecosystem from the initial custodial platforms and the lawyers who enabled independents to start, moving to centers of influence with specialized skills, to an explosion of incredibly productive fintech tools and solutions, to various integrated platforms, capital providers, thought leaders, and consultants. And our desire on today's podcast is to provide you with a better understanding of how this is unfolding. Since this is an M&A-focused podcast, let's begin by looking at the M&A process for a moment and consider the supporting ecosystem. If you have listened to previous episodes, you have heard me say how often I see many firms react to an attractive inbound phone call and the wheels start turning. This is true, by the way, for buyers too, not just sellers. So, what do most of us do when we get those phone calls? Well, we begin by focusing on valuation and doing our best to figure out how to make that a higher level if we're a seller, and figure out how to execute the transaction. But even within M&A, there's an emerging ecosystem which really determines success of the ultimate business. And it's important to take advantage of that. Bankers, transition consultants, and valuation experts all can help you better assess your value. Even more, they can help you find the right partner with whom you are aligned and offer the support and platform you need. They know how to structure transactions that will achieve the goals of both seller and buyer. And finally, the rise of capital is also a critical component of the M&A ecosystem because the leading dealmakers are deploying both debt and private equity capital to move deals forward. All of this adds up to an ecosystem that enables better execution, better alignment, and positions firms for greater chance of post-transaction success. That is, growth, productivity, and better execution for your clients can be the result. It's important to look at M&A as a strategy, as a means to a much larger objective, and not simply a transaction to execute. By tapping into the ecosystem, you can ensure better alignment and greater effectiveness and likelihood of success. There's also another level of the independent wealth management ecosystem that is important to understand and that is shaping the future of our space. There are a tremendous number of creative business models which have emerged and continue to be established, which seek to create this dynamic ecosystem. In short, you don't need to build it all yourself. In fact, you probably can't. But you can place yourself into an ecosystem model that enables you to capitalize on what you most need and surround yourself with creative leadership to help you achieve those objectives. Our guests today, Mark Spilker, Executive Chairman, and Tim Bello, Managing Partner, are leaders at Merchant Investment Management. They began several years ago by making minority investments in a number of promising RIA firms. As they have grown, they in turn have invested in several supporting service businesses that enable firms to be successful, including compliance, outsourced CFO, investment models, and most recently have established a credit business as well to be able to provide debt solutions to clients. We plan on asking them several questions on their perspectives around this M&A ecosystem that we described, as well as the larger RIA wealth management ecosystem. We want to understand how they see things going today and how this is emerging, but I think we also want to talk to them about where we see things going over the next several years and why this ecosystem idea is so central to the success of the independent wealth management industry. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thank you, Scott. We really appreciate the opportunity.
We'd like to point out that this podcast episode is being recorded on April 6, 2020, during the recent global pandemic with COVID-19. I'd like to start by asking you both, considering the health and economic concerns that are facing our nation, how does the market volatility affect or disrupt what was a landscape of record M&A activity over the last couple of years?
Yeah, thanks for that. And we just obviously want to say that we hope you and all of your families are safe, obviously the highest priority. From our point of view, the way we think about things in crisis is in three steps. Number one is everyone should be taking care of their people, their families, their friends, their partners. The second thing is think about all the defensive things that one may do to protect families and protect assets. And then the third is to prepare for opportunities that inevitably come on the other side of crisis. Obviously, transactions are more complicated to do in this environment for a whole variety of reasons. But once we get to the other side of this, which we will, the opportunity on the M&A side seems to us like it's going to grow, mostly because of the concept that in the middle of this consolidation, and re-engineering we have of the wealth space, things that otherwise would have happened will probably be accelerated. Succession, smaller firms that are maybe going to struggle, the need for uncorrelated product, the need for strategic advice, the need for partnership, the next 5 years worth of work will probably get done in the next 2 or 3 years.
Tim, anything you want to add?
Well, first off, at times like these, what really matters is what's going on at home and what's going on with your loved ones and your friends, and business is a byproduct of us all being together, but health is what matters most. That said, the opportunity is certainly there today. It will continue to grow. But the theme, it feels like more and more, will be strength in numbers. Unfortunately, we're in a tough spot, but it's going to bring people together more and more in life and in their businesses. And that's what's going to drive this M&A boom, where we've seen it. Again, it's very hard to have a true comparison to what we're dealing with right now. But just generally speaking, after times of stress, whether 0 to 02, 08, et cetera, you see this pickup.
Ecosystems, to me, serve as a fascinating framework that really help us to understand how the independent wealth management industry has both grown and evolved. And I think it provides a sense of where it may be going in the years ahead. Mark, you spent 20 years leading the asset management investment businesses at Goldman Sachs. So why don't you, for a minute, describe in your words the captive and integrated brokerage ecosystem that has been so prevalent for so many years. And what do you see as its strengths and weaknesses? And what are some of the lessons, perhaps, that you took away from that experience regarding what makes for a successful advisory business and also for a really strong, superior advisor and client relationship?
Maybe I'll just start by talking about some of the larger trends that we've seen in the industry over a long period of time, which maybe will create a context for this idea of ecosystem and the life cycle of how the industry has developed. There was a brokerage model that we had many years ago, which was really associated with transactional revenue and a lot around individual stock and bond performance. And then for a variety of reasons, the industry moved to much more of an asset management advisory model. And now we're in the next iteration where what clients and families are looking for is a more full service model. It's just not about asset management. It's about all sorts of other things we can get in at some point to talk about what we call soft services. And so when you think about that development, the larger firms we call captives, and it's not necessarily saying it in a negative way. It just means the advisors work at a firm. The firm is a full service delivery mechanism. And inside those firms, they control all of the factors of production, compliance, trade processing, asset allocation, special investments, and all sorts of other things. And we call that captive because the advisors work for the firms. Those firms become one-stop shops, and they're excellent business models, but they own every single part of the value chain. Large scale, vertically integrated corporate models, as the big captives are, can provide a lot of resources. But one of the things that becomes more difficult is to deliver flexibility, deliver innovation, deliver entrepreneurship, because everything has to be done on scale. And so it tends to move towards servicing the average client. The opportunity for the independent space is to deliver a more flexible and innovative business model, both for advisors to work and for clients. And so it's a preference. And so the way we have seen the industry develop, where the value chain has been unbundled, meaning independent advisors can now outsource and co-source many of the factors of production, they can custom build their firms for what they think is the right environment for their advisors to thrive and the right environment for their clients. The critical issue goes back to essentially what we're talking here is ecosystem. In the large scale wealth management firms that we call captives, they have all of the resources that one would need. They have built their own internally controlled ecosystem, whereas independent advisors now, especially the best run independent firms, have to participate in some kind of ecosystem if they want to deliver best-in-class services mm-hmm. to their clients. And at Merchant, we work really hard on building what we call a distributed, collaborative partnership model. Independent firms, both wealth firms and service providing firms and asset management firms, where if you participate in this ecosystem, that we believe that you can have access to the same world-class resources, but not have to own all the factors of production as an independent firm on your own. We, again, believe what's going on in the industry is increasing choice. We don't believe that there is a single model that is going to win. But when we decided 4 years ago to create Merchant, we thought there was an opportunity, and I think it has been validated by our success and where the industry is going, that to create a 21st century method of operating in the wealth space in a world-class way. And one of those was the idea that if you look at the way a wealth firm, optimal running of a wealth firm, there's many of the, what I call factors of production, compliance, books and records, asset management, trade entry, tax prep, financial planning, insurance, a whole variety of those functions that can be outsourced and co-sourced. An independent firm can have the advantage of being entrepreneurial, innovative, and yet through participation in an ecosystem, have access to world-class resources. So ultimately, their clients can get the benefit of the close personal relationship they want with their advisor, yet access to all the world-class goods and services that are required in order to best service those families.
You know, the ecosystem is a broad term. There's two ecosystems. There's the essential ecosystem and there's the optional ecosystem. But it's almost a difference between, does somebody have to consume something when they're in a captive environment, or do they have the choice to consume something when they're in an open architecture environment? So that's an overall theme. One is essential versus optional, but building the right blend of the two. The second point that I like to make is ecosystems aren't really business plans. Ecosystems show themselves over time based upon, from what we've seen, your action in the market. And in order to understand the action of the market, you have to be in the market. And the best way to get in the market is to put your time, which is valuable, and your capital, which is valuable, into the market and create a real alignment of interest with any type of business to understand the nooks and crannies of each business to better see where they fit into the ecosystem. Three, you know, to build an ecosystem, you need to understand timing, the opportunity, the people that you need to pull it together, right? It's almost like they say you can build the plane while you're flying it. That's sort of what at least we've seen, right, is you've got to be on the ground. And the other thing, too, is when we've been building this ecosystem, learning on the job, it's important, at least we've seen, to hurry slowly. And off the back of an initial entry, principal, durable, equity investing, we've been really fortunate where the market has come to us. And through that, we've been able to build this ecosystem.
Well, I think that sounds like true responsive innovation that what both of you are describing here. Frankly, I think what we see is a lot of different versions of ecosystems that are creating. And I think, and the last thing I'd say, Tim, is what I hear out of that is what you see as an ecosystem is we're trying to be responsive to as we see the needs evolving as we build out our business. I mean, I think you used the word, the phrase controlled chaos.
Sure. It's something Mark taught me, but all kidding aside, controlled chaos is really just another way of saying, you know, give yourself the freedom to realize and execute off the back of creativity. It's one thing to say you're in one lane. It's another thing to say you're on a multi-lane highway. It's a whole other thing to be able to be on that multi-lane highway and not get into an accident. We've got a bunch of people that know how to drive the cars they're in and drive them on one highway together to get to the same destination. You know, it's a really good environment to operate in, right? Because you have controlled chaos. You have the ability to see down the road, but you also have the ability to zig and zag to get to the destination.
You know, one of the things I see in to build on what you both have shared is we've gone through over three decades now of accelerating growth in the independent space that I think has led to an exciting surge of a lot of different creative entrepreneurial innovations, first in the RIA models themselves, but subsequently as the supporting ecosystem expanded from kind of a custody platform to fintech tools and platforms, and now to capital and a lot of supporting thought leaders and consultants and bankers and so forth. As you look at M&A over the last 5 to 10 years, what have been the innovations that you have seen as far as how that has unfolded and what's been going on? Just some of your observations. What might be described as a wealth management M&A ecosystem from your perspective?
One of the things that, at least from our point of view, is the idea of growth. Many advisors talk about, I want to grow, and many have had challenges growing organically. So M&A has been a good way to grow, which is perfectly fine. But we just want to point out that, well, we divide the word growth into two pieces. One is growing in terms of size, and the second is growing in terms of capabilities. Size doesn't necessarily mean better, that ultimately independent firms have to create increasingly better environments for their advisors to thrive, and they have to create better value propositions ultimately for their clients. That's what M&A should really be about. And that's the first principle that's really important. And then the second principle is M&A is really a strategic transaction, but it's not about the transaction. And so we tend to focus on the post-transaction impact of the merger as opposed to just getting the merger done. It is hard enough to find compatible firms. It's hard enough to find compatible personality types, and it's hard to find compatible economics. But once you get past all that, that's just the starting line. And the value has to be created once the transaction is closed. How does the integration work? Have you made the cost side of the business more efficient? But have you made the value delivery mechanism to end clients better? And that, to us, is really the most important principle when you think about M&A.
No, I think Mark said it perfectly. And to add to it, look, it's not easy to get something done, but it's not hard. What is hard is integration, intelligent growth, the enhancement of one's return on time as a B2C and B2B business owner and operator, and also doing this while maintaining culture. All too often, it seems, in quote-unquote M&A, people look at it as a transaction, whether it's capital needed or not, a transaction. It's way more than that. And so that's the first thing, is it's a mixture of art and science. I think when you're doing M&A, you have to be aware of your audience, who you're dealing with, the buyer, the seller, the destination, and the one traveling there, and what each party is looking to accomplish. Once you figure out all the qualitative pieces, you can go into the commoditized aspect of the coming together, which is the science, which is the statistics, which is the structuring, which is the capital injection, whether it's debt or equity. So just going back for a second, you know, you've got a couple, I used the word essential before in the description of an ecosystem. You have a couple of essential pieces of M&A, and capital or no capital, so resources, the ability to design what that will all look like, and then willingness. Is the business that's making the investment in the other company or absorbing the other business, are they really deal ready? I think one of the things we've seen is that a lot of people, as we all do, have aspirations to go somewhere with their life, with their business. There's a big difference between wanting to and being able to. We have to make sure as an industry that businesses are deal ready on the front end, and then deal ready on the back end after something's done, to absorb these companies and bring everything together as a cohesive operation, enterprise, business, again, for the operators and for the clients.
One of the themes I've stressed since the beginning of this podcast series, now in our second season on this, has been the importance of understanding why you're doing the transaction in the first place. In my last episode of the podcast, it was all around the discussion of the topic of scale that both of you just mentioned. I mean, I think a lot of the larger serial acquirers and enterprises are focused on this idea of integration and scale. And I think the benefits of scale, you know, are pretty clear, you know, greater productivity, functional depth, career opportunities, brand building. But many entrepreneurial firms are also concerned on the other side of scale, and I'd love to hear how you both think about this, brings a multitude of, you know, difficult challenges, everything from maintaining a consistent culture, Tim, something you just talked about, trying to get the effective leadership. I don't think a lot of these firms necessarily have built out people who are used to leading large-scale organizations. And then a strong and personal relationship that they want to maintain with their clients. And in other words, I think there's been this tension between a desire for autonomy and independence, and a need for scale. How do you both look at that in your own system and your own approach to this as you build out merchant?
Yep, it's a great question. And it really goes to first principles for merchant, which is, again, this ecosystem where when you think about what an advisor has to be good at in order to be successful, we tend to think about the client-facing and market-facing activities. And yet, as you point out, there are all sorts of other things that are required in order to have a great firm. One of the things that we had identified early when we decided to build Merchant was the Merchant Method, minority, non-control, collaborative partnerships. We, on our team, have certain skills and experiences broadly across the industry that we, in partnership with the firms that we're partners with, that they don't have to build all that stuff internally. We could be an extension of their management. And again, it's like the benefits of working in a large firm, but not having to employ all of these people or have to build it yourselves. So the idea of strategic partnership, and I just want to break that down into two pieces, because as you said, alluded to before, there's a spectrum. Some transactions that are happening are purely financial in nature. Seller wants to monetize, buyer wants to get return on capital. And the other side of the spectrum is pure operating. You see large firms acquiring smaller firms and fully integrating. Both of those things are perfectly fine. We have a third method, which we think is a mix of financial capital and operating expertise, where the whole idea is a firm could take on somebody like Merchant as a minority, but strategic partner, where it's just not the financial capital that is what drives the transaction and the forward value, but the ability of the collective team, including not just the Merchant team, but all of the other firms in the ecosystem, where you could effectively feel like you're virtually part of a large firm. So strategic partnerships, with an emphasis on the term strategic, because it's operating value, non-fiduciary operating value, as opposed to just financial value.
You know, first thing is, it's one thing to be independent. It's another thing to be independent by yourself. It's a whole other thing, which is what most people really want. It's just human nature to be independent, but together. Back to the beginning of Merchant, we all had our own independent ideas. Mark, Scott, myself, Brian, David, Rick, the team. But you can't do any of that unless you're together with people. You've got to learn to share. I know it sounds so elementary, and it is, but it is so important. That's the first thing, independent but together. The second thing is, we're in a people business. So if you're in a people business, you got to be around people to do the right thing all the time. And then the other thing is, when people go independent, when businesses go independent, they always think about what can be done for them through the exercise, for their clients, for them. The other thing is, what about the CPA's mentality of thinking about what independence can do to you? We all have to be aware of how to identify, mitigate the operational risk, the reputational risk, the result-based risk as it relates to investing. You got to make sure whatever you're building is got to be built to last. And you don't do that by yourself. You do that with a group of people. You do that with an ecosystem. You do that with a network. And you do that with a durable partner. The other thing, too, is I've noticed over the last 3 to 6 months, business owners and advisors that are joining other big firms through M&A, I feel like the industry has to redefine what it means to own something and what the definition in wealth management is of equity.
Tim, could you just clarify one thing that I thought was an interesting observation? You said the way we look at equity today, and maybe it's getting to this issue of kind of minority versus majority stake or something with that. Say a little bit more of what you meant there.
Yeah, I mean, it could be majority versus minority. It could be control versus non-control. It could be a debate over, you know, is it 24-9, is it 25, is it 50, is it 51, is it 100%? What it really meant, though, Scott, was when somebody says to the acquiring firm, I want equity, it's very important that the advisor asks themselves the question, what is equity? You know, all too often we think of equity as I have to own the building, I have to own the dirt, I have to own the house. Well, in our business, equity is actually a multiple applied to a revenue stream that is profit. So profits measured as in one of two ways, EBITDA, EBOX. So profit, distributable cash, with a multiple applied to it. That's equity. Equity is not the ADV. Equity, right? So we can, again, we can go off on what that is, but it comes up very often. And I think a lot of times in M&A, that not defining what equity is stops the conversation before it even starts between the two firms. And you can't solve how to come together if you can't understand the interests of each party. Again, I know it sounds simple, but too many people jump right to the end. What are your assets? How many clients do you have? How much were you down this last quarter? No. Let's start with the first principles.
So it puts a lot on the, frankly, on the advisors themselves to start thinking about what they really want and why. And I think that's a great question. One of the things we found through the Fidelity M&A Leaders Forum is that, as we discussed with a lot of serial buyers, is that they see still, even today, a lot of independent firms who are reluctant to even consider selling or partnering because they like the independence they have. As we talk about this ecosystem and kind of some of the options out there, how do you think firms today should consider the importance of rethinking how they define independence in order to be able to do a better job of serving their clients? And what do you think is keeping firms from being more willing to entertain offers?
Well, I think Tim really hit on it before, which is you could be independent and alone or independent and together. And that's essentially the big distinction between whether you're participating and collaborating in an ecosystem versus you're literally in an office where you're trying to figure out everything on your own. There's so much of this industry that seems very complicated to an advisor because the typical advisor has one set of skills, but there are many other people in the industry that know how to solve that issue. And if you just had access to it, this idea of the answer being one phone call away, I think now the independent firms that want to go it alone, do their own thing, not participate in an ecosystem, are going to have more challenges. And the reason why we think they're going to have more challenges is because the demands that clients are going to place on their advisors to be more holistic, more knowledgeable, have greater access, that is going up. And so the quality of the offering has to improve. And the only way that it can improve is understanding what's going on at the center of the industry. There are many advisors out there that A, want to remain independent, B, want to control their own firms, want to have the majority of the economics, but want to have a partner that is going to substantially increase the probability that they make it successfully to the other side. And that's this whole idea of collaborative partnerships, participating in the ecosystem. Don't think of the ecosystem as a central services model. Think of an ecosystem as a variety of independent firms that can organize themselves to, in some virtual way, act like together it's one big firm. And in addition, it's not just that advisors can take stuff from the ecosystem, it's advisors can give stuff to the ecosystem. What we witness in our ecosystem are many of the independent firms actually working together. One firm is excellent at financial planning, and the other firm is excellent at insurance. If you're in this environment that we believe that can be created, you can trust the other firms in the ecosystem by virtue of the fact that we collaborate, you've met them, that if you're not great in financial planning, you can work collaboratively with one of the other firms in the ecosystem to improve where you are in financial planning or on insurance. And that has the benefit, again, of you could put things into the ecosystem and potentially garner economics for it, which makes you a valuable member of the ecosystem. It's a two-way street. And then, of course, the more we all know about networks, the more nodes you have in the network, the more valuable the network becomes.
The fingerprint of the ecosystem is consumer driven. Think about that. It's not merchant driven. We're not a manufacturing and distribution shop of services and capital. We're more reactive to broad-based opportunity, but really the needs and the wants of the consumer. Many advisors that run their own companies, rightfully so, it's hard to let your guard down. Okay, there's a lot of capital, there's a lot of ideas, there's equity, there's credit, there's smart people, there's big balance sheets, there's big reputations, and you have is local business, whether it's $50 million advisor or $5 billion business, is still small on a relative basis. Entry to the ecosystem is different for different people. There's no such thing as right or wrong. It's what's right for you. An advisor can come into this, into the ecosystem. And if they want some compliance, because that's where their gap is, that's fine. They don't have to take the capital and it's a non-threatening ecosystem. And then lastly, what Mark said is, you know, an ecosystem is good when the advisory firm can actually put as much or if not more into the ecosystem relative to what they take out.
So, I mean, this is a very helpful description, because I think what you both described to me over the course of this is that your ecosystem is kind of a loosely integrated system that opens up the opportunity. And the idea of one call away, I think, is very powerful. I'd like to explore that for just a second. The analogy I might use would be maybe going to Home Depot on a Saturday with not a real plan, and you start seeing all of the options that are available to you there, and then you start perhaps buying a few tools and stuff, but you don't really have a plan, or you aren't even aware of some of the other capabilities that are or resources that are available in the store. How do you encourage advisors who may come into your ecosystem to take advantage of either their peers or some of the other resources you have? How do you help them to figure that out?
I could think back to when I was at Goldman and I was responsible for the wealth business there. And one of the great advantages a firm like Goldman has, and there are many other great firms, there's this idea of passing best practices around the system. There are certain things that are working in one place and not working in other places. And each advisor does not need to reinvent the wheel. That the advantage of working in a big firm is that you could see the things that are being successful, and that in your own practice, you could emulate that. And that is very, very powerful. And so what we try to do in our system is create that same dynamic without everyone working in the same company. And it all comes down to communication. And one of the things we work hard to do is to communicate not only bilaterally, but create lots of connections between the firms. We will sit down and see the different things different firms are working, you know, the things that are working, the things that are not working, and continue to communicate to each firm bilaterally, and then connect them so that they could have those relationships on their own, independent firms, but have access to all the knowledge of what's going on in the other firms.
Well, let's as we start to wind up here, I think you've outlined a really exciting unfolding of the ecosystem model, using yours as an example, but seeing a variety of different alternatives and options that's going on in the industry right now. As wealth management evolves over the next 5 to 10 years, we expect to see a handful of large scale branded firms and quite a few focused niche firms, but that it's going to be harder to play in the middle. But, you know, I'd say those branded scaled firms, we've probably been thinking more in terms of, you know, more of an integrated model. Tell us a little bit about where you see the industry going over the next 10 years, because I think it's an exciting vision that you both bring to it in terms of what's going to change and what will be the principles that will drive it.
Again, it's such a large industry, so there's going to be all sorts of different things that will work and not work. But at the large level, we think there are going to be three surviving firm types. One, the big scale players. Those businesses are doing really well and will continue to do well. Then I think there will be still many smaller niche firms that don't necessarily operate at a level of scale, but can build such bespoke and customized relationships with their clients that'll work for clients. And then the space that we're playing in, which is the increasingly capable independent advisor, where as we're talking about, scale is becoming more important, but doing scale in this kind of distributed way. And those seem to us to be the three blocks of opportunities. And what's really nice, we don't think one is better than the other. We think now advisors, both entrepreneur and producing advisors, have choices as to where they could work or set up a shop. And clients have more choices than they've ever had. And what we like about the 21st century method and the 21st century world in the wealth space is that the power is shifting back to the end client where it really should reside.
The truth of the matter is that you're seeing a real separating and coming back together of manufacturers and distributors from infrastructure providers. And what's happening is, at least it seems, and then I'll answer the question more specifically, but it seems that people are becoming more and more okay as they become more and more independent. They're becoming more okay with allowing the peers under the hood of their business because they realize that you can really create some synthetic leverage, right? The minute you understand your goals and then understand your gaps, you have to then overcome the fear of allowing someone else that you deem to be your competitor to fill your gap. And the minute you can do that, it creates so much opportunity for everybody, the clients, the operators, the advisors, et cetera. And the real question is, there's really no right number, but the real question is, will it be 10? Will it be 20? Will it be 50? Will those be, Scott, the Home Depots that you mentioned, right? Where they truly are financial services enterprises. I find it very hard to consistently use the word a wealth management firm more and more each day, because many firms are going from wealth management firms to financial services companies.
Well, this has been a really helpful discussion. One of the takeaways I'm hearing in our conversation is that on the one hand, they're really what you just described, Tim, there are more options open to advisors in terms of the direction they want to take their business than there's ever been, whether that's just, you know, partners and collaborators or investors or ecosystem elements that we talked about. But at the same time, this freedom of choice makes for more responsibility, I would say, to actually make a decision on the part of those firms. So as we close, I'd love to hear from each of you. What would be your one piece of advice for advisors who are listening to us today, who are looking to engage with this ecosystem so that they really can take advantage of it?
Ask a lot of questions, make phone calls, look at all the different models out there, assess what all the choices are. But ultimately, what is most important is to try to figure out what kind of firm do you want to build and be self-aware and realistic about what the chances of getting there on your own. And if you feel very comfortable that you could do it, then the rewards will be plentiful. But if you feel like you need help, then try to figure out how to participate in an ecosystem, either just as part of a collaborator or build with a firm like Merchant an economic alignment. The idea is, in selling a piece of your firm does not mean that your economics are worse. You should do it if you think that over a long period of time, the partnership will create greater value collectively than one could create on their own.
Tim, you want to? What's your piece of advice?
There's no monopoly on good ideas. So number one, Merchant's in the business of listening to, understanding, and helping people execute off the back of their ideas. Number two, many of us at Merchant and many of the folks at Fidelity and throughout the industry, we're all in the business of building businesses. So if you want help to build your business, to bring your idea to life, to play defense on your life's work, just let's have a conversation.
Great. Well, I think both of you are really highlighting a key theme that of this podcast over our entire couple of seasons, which is take the time to get educated, to ask good questions, to really explore what's out there. And this idea of ecosystem, I think, broadens the capabilities for every advisor if they look into it and take advantage of it. So Mark and Tim, I just want to thank you for your great insights, for the time you've given us today, and for sharing this with our audience. So thank you very, very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for hosting us.
That's it for us today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Future Ready through M&A. I'm your host, Scott Slater, reminding you to be future ready.
Future Ready through M&A is a production of Fidelity's Clearing and Custody Solutions with help from Collective Next. Got a question or a comment? Email us at fidelitynamesites@fmr.com. Any reproduction, transcripts, or rebroadcast of this content are forbidden without explicit permission. This asset is for investment professional use only, not for distribution to the public as sales material in any form. The content provided herein is general in nature and is for informational purposes only. This information is not individualized and is not intended to serve as the primary or sole basis for your decisions as there may be other factors you should consider. Fidelity Clearing and Custody Solutions does not provide financial or investment advice. You should conduct your due diligence and analysis based on your specific needs. Information provided in this document is for informational and educational purposes only. To the extent any investment information in this material is deemed to be a recommendation, it is not meant to be impartial investment advice or advice in a fiduciary capacity, and it is not intended to be used as a primary basis for you or your clients' investment decisions. Fidelity and its representatives may have a conflict of interest in the products or services mentioned in this material because they have a financial interest in them and receive compensation directly or indirectly in connection with the management, distribution, and/or servicing of these products or services, including Fidelity funds, certain third-party funds, and products and certain investment services. The third-party providers listed herein are neither affiliated with nor an agent of Fidelity and are not authorized to make representations on behalf of Fidelity. Their input herein does not suggest a recommendation or an endorsement by Fidelity. This information was provided to the third-party providers in a subject change. Fidelity takes no responsibility whatsoever nor in any way endorses any such content. There is no form of legal partnership, agency affiliation, or similar relationship among an investment professional, the third-party service providers, and Fidelity Investments, nor is such a relationship created or implied by the information herein. Third-party trademarks and all service marks are the property of their respective owners. All other trademarks and service marks are the property of FMR LLC or its affiliated companies. Fidelity Institutional Asset Management, or FIAM, provides registered investment products via Fidelity Distributors Company, LLC, an institutional asset management service through FIAM, LLC, or Fidelity Institutional Asset Management Trust Company. Fidelity Clearing and Custody Solutions provides clearing, custody, and other brokerage services through National Financial Services, LLC, or Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Members NYSE, SIPC, 200 Seaport Boulevard, Z2B1, Boston, Massachusetts, 02210, 2020, FMR, LLC, all rights preserved. 917-838.1.0. For further information, please reference The Myths and Realities of Business Ecosystems, MIT Sloan Management Review, February 25th, 2019, and The Wide Lens, What Successful Innovators See That Others Miss, by Rod Adner, published in 2013. Mm-hmm.